And now, Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairdes.
Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund in the office of Irrational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the Art Deco winter that is the Eastern Columbia. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, and I'm here, as always, with the co-host, Mr. Phil Lairdes.
I would like to point out a couple of things. One, please. The fact that you are speeding through the opening can only indicate to listeners what an action-packed
show
this is going to be.
So action-packed.
And two, you could actually save time on the intro by realizing that you're doubling up since Mr. Garrett Watley introduces us and the show and has done so now for quite some time.
Oh, yeah, right. I forgot. Thanks, Garrett.
And this is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. This is not combat radio.
No.
Though you've come to hear us on combat radio. People have come to hear us on combat radio now quite often.
Quite often. Yes. It's become sort of a regular thing we do with Ethan.
We are regular contributors to combat radio.
Yep.
With Ethan Dettenmeyer.
How did that happen?
I don't know. Yeah, it's fun, though.
I like it. This is hilarious.
You know, he will be a guest. We will be filming. We'll be making another appearance very soon on Combat Radio to discuss Truth Is Out There 2 and 3. And we will be filming that appearance, shooting that appearance for inclusion in potentially one of those movies. And at the same time, we will pre-record. Oh, I'm not supposed to say
what? No, you can't say it. Well,
it's out of the bag now. Yeah. We will pre-record an installment of Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Ethan as our guest, as well as his frequent co-host, Mark Ryan.
As a separate guest. Why don't we get two shows?
No,
all four of us.
Because it'll be done at the same time,
Oh, right, on there.
It'll be a crossover. A
fantastic crossover.
It'll be like
show.
A $6 million man, Bionic Woman crossover. No, that's not right, because they were the same.
That was the pilot.
What would it be? It would be more like Ally McBeal and The Practice.
How about Picket Fences and
Chicago Hope.
And Chicago Hope. No, Picket Fences and Richard Belzer was on Picket Fences.
Homicide. I think there was a Picket Fences Chicago Hope, though.
Was there?
Yeah, those are all David. We've just named like 90 David E. Kelly shows.
We got only 300 more to go.
How about Boston Public and Boston Legal? Those were crossovers as well.
How about Hill Street Blues and Cop Rock?
No, that never happened.
No, it didn't. It should have, though. I would have.
How about Homicide and the X-Files?
Oh, that was good. It happened.
We have a winner.
Yes.
Yeah, Richard Belzer. Again, all roads. Why don't we just have Richard Belzer on the show?
Come
and then
on.
It's a crossover between Joe Biden. But we have him as his character. So then it is a Homicide.
Picket Fences.
Law and Order. X-Files crossover with Chilpack Hollywood.
I think he actually holds the record for the most episodes as the same character. So he's always played the same detective, but in four different shows, four different series. Isn't that something?
Indeed.
Wow. Okay, that's not what
we're
going to talk about, though.
With the 3 minutes we spent, which some could argue
meandering,
were wasted.
Wasted.
3 minutes. Although, who can show up at work and immediately get right to work? As George Carlin always said, you never, ever see a memo 9:01 a.m.
It's true.
You know, to hell with the company, the first 15 minutes are yours.
Man, you got to get coffee. The seat's got to be right. What about your lighting? All of that.
There are the most extraordinary sounds coming from the interns here at Rational Exuberance. Our interns are actually two Dobermen, but
yes, and they make extraordinary sounds.
I want to begin with a news story that is right up your alley.
It sure is.
It's one of maybe the only things about which Dean Haglund will get passionate. It's Hollywood history and architecture.
All together at last.
And the lack of respect for same.
Ugh.
John Giroudo wrote to let us know that Pickfair Studios is in danger of being demolished.
Demolished, of all things.
Permission has already been granted to demolish, although as yet undertaken.
Right.
The demolishing has been approved of the Writers Building, which sits at the East Gate on Formosa. And the intention is to tear down the sound stages also to make room for a glass office tower.
No, yeah, of course, because that's exactly what you want on
people
the old
one. People in glass room. Office towers should not throw stones at Pickfair Studios.
Well, here's the thing. Pickfair Studios, now the Samuel Golden lot, I believe they call it. Or the Warner, it's part of the Warner Brothers owned.
Well, Warner used to own it.
Yes, and who got it now?
It used to be Warner Hollywood, right?
Right.
On Formosa. So this is part of that.
It's part of that whole thing. So this was built by...
It's now just known as The Lot.
The Lot, right.
I think it's entirely independent. I don't think it's...
Oh, it is. Okay. So here's the problem, and I understand it, because these things, often built in a hurry in the 20s, have structural issues. A lot of them...
Oh, they do.
Yes. The writers' buildings and that sort of thing... Often not built to code, often built by the guys who were set builders, who often had no engineering or construction talent. And as Chaplin always did, he built his houses using movie set guy constructions, and they always fell apart. And his house was actually called Breakaway for the longest time.
Right. I think it's unfair maybe to say that they didn't have construction talent in that sense.
Right.
I think the term piece that you're getting at that's very interesting to me is that we look back on this historic location.
Yes.
Fondly.
Fondly.
Rightly so. At the same time, they may have intended it as a temporary structure.
They may
I have no way of knowing.
Right. Or they built it to the cheapest standards possible because they had no money because they were just starting out on a brand new studio. So
it's like the old joke that occasionally comes to mind, except when one reads a book like John Adams by David McCullough. But it's the joke that comes to mind about the founding fathers and, you know, the intense, passionate arguments that get continued throughout the ages about the intent, sticking to the intent of the framers of the Constitution. And the joke being, if they were around today and seeing what? The way we live and the technology we have, they would say, really? You're spending this much time worrying about this piece of paper we came up with 250 years ago when we still all own slaves.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the same idea that there was a different time. And so I can understand when technology moves beyond the capacity of studios and whatever to accommodate filmmaking as it is today. However, to tear down historical things for a glass office tower, I can't really cotton to, particularly in that part of town where there's mostly residential. That thing will stick out, sadly, like a very tall sore thumb.
This seems to be the crux of the problem, perhaps.
Perhaps. Now, they don't.
Do we need a glass office tower? Right. I see nothing but empty office space for lease everywhere I go, including in Hollywood.
How about here at the historic core? There's about 1 million square feet of office space unused right here on Broadway.
Ah. Now, would we have the same problem if perhaps it was being built to be affordable, low-income housing?
Well, there you go. But then,
but we don't do that because that will reduce the
amount of
property value in the neighborhood by bringing in undesirables.
Right. And therefore...
We love the idea of low-income housing, just not in my neighborhood. Not in my backyard, mister.
Yeah. And so I could see the writer building coming down. The sound stage is another thing altogether, because those are actually where great silent films were filmed, and, of course, in the 20s.
And also, as someone in the neighborhood, this is not a small project.
No.
Demolishing something, building something, the people who do live near there, and the people who work on the lot. Hello.
Hello.
And
parking issues.
There are theaters. There are stage theaters over there. Already existing businesses, of course. What a nightmare for all of these people from a traffic, parking, and noise standpoint.
I can see maybe the writer's building. I would say the concession is the writer's building, but keep the sound stages. But then clearly they're not interested in or they're not renting out those sound stages like they used to. And chances are they think that having office spaces where you could put digital workstations, have special effects houses, all move in there with, you know, T3 lines and stuff like that is a more economically viable way of handling your money that you make from your lot.
We will put this link on the description of the show if people want to learn more. SaveThePickFairStudio.wordpress.com. They can learn more about it.
Absolutely. And they don't offer public tours there. That's the other thing. It is still a private lot. So even that these things exist, they're not doing any sort of open to the public aspect to it. So again, you're going to have... it's a horrible issue. I hate this. I hate when this happens because it really, you know, detracts from the idea that Hollywood burns down its own history over and over again.
Indeed. Indeed.
Okay.
We love to celebrate the live event.
A live event!
On your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. So let's get started. Live event of the week.
Danny in the Deep Blue Sea.
I thought maybe you would pause there so you would know where to cut in the...
Right. It's right there. Anyway.
The Chill Pack Hollywood live event of the week.
Well, now we'll want to cut all this out.
Will we?
Oh, my God. That's awful.
I know. We'll
all right.
That in.
We saw, collectively, we saw something.
Collectively.
Along with Ethan Tenmeyer of Combat Radio.
Yeah.
Earlier in the day, I saw at the Getty Villa.
Oh, right.
Songs of Bilitis.
Yes.
This is a fantastic story about one of the real life great frauds perpetrated in literature. Famous French poet, 1880s, 1890s.
Uh-huh.
Translated a previously undiscovered work from a Greek poetess.
Oh.
A contemporary of Sappho. And these translations were racy and erotic. They were love poems. And this man translated this woman from ancient Greece, translated her poems beautifully and caused quite a stir, quite a... reaction, quite a controversy, and quite commercial success.
Uh-huh.
And it turned out to be fraudulent. There was no such poetess. This is a play about this.
Wow.
The angle the play takes, which wonderfully uses many different medium, film projection, puppetry, because it is from the point of view of how these poems appear to the poet, the modern poet, the French poet, in the first place, through his muse.
Ah.
And so this interesting question comes about, you know, in the mind of the viewer. How do we judge, and this gets back to that movie that I was talking about, Carbon Copy, about the painting. And
right, right.
How do we judge what is a forgery, what is fraudulent,
right,
if what is created
is fantastic?
Is art.
Right.
However we define art, if we can say that what is produced is art, then is it less art because the story behind it is somehow fraudulent.
Right. Typical of Jeff Koons, who always explores this, by taking balloon animals to a steel manufacturing place, having them enlarge it to 32 feet high, make it out of aluminum, and then he sells that as a piece of artwork for millions of dollars. Jeff Koons' balloon animals.
And what is really interesting is this concept of how do ideas come to an artist in any form, this idea of the muse. And if the muse is truly a voice that the artist is listening to, and it is a voice that the artist does not identify as self, which I think most, knowing a little something about creating art, when most of us are doing truly compelling work, we are aware that this is something flowing through us and it is not us. We have tapped into something, be it collective, be it unconscious, whatever it is, we can't even have big enough egos to identify with the source of this. And so is an artist personifying this source and giving this source a backstory? Is that kind of storytelling not in and of itself art as opposed to fraud?
Right, right.
It's telling a story. The story of how he made these poems that he has concocted is no less a beautiful story in and of itself. And truly, since they're making a play about it, it might be the story that this was all about to begin with.
Right. That could even be...
All wow. That said, this was a work in progress commissioned by the Getty.
Yeah.
At the Getty Villa, which has... I did not know. You asked me if this was in the outdoor amphitheater.
Yeah, I saw
they
the outdoor.
Have an incredible state-of-the-art movie and stage venue.
Wow.
Inside the Getty Villa. It's gorgeous stadium seating, great sight lines.
How many
technological
seats?
Technological state of the art, several hundred seats.
Wow.
It's fantastic. I would think a great place to act in a show.
I would love that.
And it was a work in progress. Many of the things that were a little bit problematic, they only had 2 weeks of direction in that venue once they got the workshop up. So there were problems from, not problems, but there were seams showing, let's say. Those will all be worked through before its debut in 2013. However, I'm not sure this dog will ever hunt. Because the one thing that they fail, at least for me, reaction was incredible from the audience.
Right.
As might be so often the case when there's lots of nudity and simulated sex.
Woohoo!
Which lets you know it's art.
Yes, of course.
And it was art. That doesn't necessarily make it satisfying. And one of the challenges with any piece that deals with an artist and deals with the creative process is how do you engage us in such a way from the outset that we care?
Right. And that was the thing with...
How does the artist's creative process relate in a universal way?
To a larger...
And it's the folly of artists so often, of writers and filmmakers, and especially, to think there is something uniquely interesting about our own process.
Right. Yes.
And that is not... necessarily so. And in fact, it's why when I travel around and people want me to talk about what I do, I'm not interested. I want to learn about what you do.
Exactly.
Don't you understand that that's interesting to me? But we do seem to fall into this trap. I think part of it is write what you know. Everyone says write what you know. And so many people who are telling stories have simply been studying how to tell stories and haven't been studying the world, haven't been studying humanities.
Getting out there.
And so I think that's one of the problems, but it really is this trap whenever anyone makes a piece about a creative person. You know, you have to relate it, I think, in some way. And here I am, a creative person who understands the process, and I'm not even engaged.
Right. That's odd. And if you're not engaged when there's nudity and simulated sex going on, then there's...
Although, to be honest, that was part of the problem, because these were incredibly erotic and evocative poems. And I felt that the makers of this either felt uncomfortable themselves with the depth of the energy expressed in these poems.
Right.
Or they simply didn't have faith that poetry itself could carry the piece.
Ah. That
but
might be
so
the bigger
often
issue.
The sexual is rendered simply as sex, as opposed to the deep, dark energy of the sexual
and the mystery.
And so for those reasons, I'm not sure this piece will work when it debuts in 2013. However, who can pass judgment this early in the process?
Still a long way away.
They, like John Carter, might have 28 days of reshoots that renders the whole thing
absolutely
irrelevant.
Ah, poor John.
Later that night, however, we saw a piece.
There we go.
That, according to Lily Holloman, you have not lived until you've seen this production of this play.
That's it.
So we have now. We have now lived.
We've lived. It's true. Danny in the Deep Blue Sea by John
Patrick
Shanley.
Written in 1984.
I know.
Wasn't that a little bit stunning to find out 1984? Because I felt it could have very easily been written a year ago.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. The way Shanley wrote, it was very breakthrough in the 80s. I remember his stuff, everybody going gaga for its realism and its gritty, not verite. What's the other word that I'm looking for? Verisimilitude?
I don't know. Yeah, it's not verite because it is very artfully written.
Yes.
It is very heavily written.
Yes.
In fact, at some points in watching this production at Crown City Theater starring the fantastic Juliet Landau.
Yes, fantastic.
It, at sometimes I felt it was becoming too written.
Right.
I worried about it.
And you did.
This is,
I worried about that.
Well, this is the trick. You know, you see bad theater and you see the pitfalls or you see plays that don't work and why they don't work, even plays by great playwrights. And you, as we've talked about before, your greatest strength can always become your greatest weakness. And when any artist is too rewarded for doing something, sometimes they fall into the trap of trying to repeat that.
Right.
That gained them those rewards, which is a separation from what made it authentic in the first place.
Absolutely.
So there were moments when I began to worry about how written it was. And then there's a false ending in the piece.
Yes.
And I began to worry when the lights came back up if the way out of this false ending is as written as what led us to it. I'm very concerned.
But that
if he's going to use crafted writing to get us out of the crafted writing, right? Then you're just meeting the thing with the thing.
Right.
And instead, what followed was so simple and so pure and authentic. Not only was it dramatic and emotional and did it resonate, it actually relied, a great deal of its success relied on the artificiality of what came earlier.
Of in the first scene.
Because as I was saying, if you had the ending to Danny and the Deep Blue Sea, and it's a showstopper.
It is.
Literally.
Yeah.
But the ending is so powerful. If you had just gone to that ending, there would have been many people who walked out going, well, that's not very believable.
Right.
If you precede it by an unbelievable ending, then all the question about whether the actual ending is unbelievable has already been removed.
Right, because you've already showed that.
It's kind of the trick of when the cat got out of the bag in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, about Spock was going to die.
Uh-huh.
And people were outraged about it.
Right.
They said, how can we turn the release of this information into a strength?
Uh-huh.
Now the film has to build up to that ending.
Right.
But again, because it was originally at the end of Act One.
Oh.
So they said, well, it has to build up to that now. And then the second point was they're still going to know about it. So what do we do? Oh, what if we stage a fake death early in the film?
Aha. Uh-huh.
And then people will begin to think, oh, we've been played. This is what we heard about.
Yeah.
He doesn't really die. The people that were on the set and let that slip didn't understand that this was fake.
Right.
So then we relax into the rest of the movie and enjoy it until
he really does die.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny because
using that kind of sleight of hand.
And it's funny, I've never actually seen a full production of this. I've seen many scenes done in scene study class.
Right.
It's a classic two-hander that actors and acting classes use all the time to have basically a male and female get either into gritty reality, because the guy who plays it is very rough, manly, and she, you both are Brooklyn, Bronx. You know, they do Bronx accents, the whole thing. So it's interesting to see it structurally all hold together, because all the times I've seen it, I've always thought, well, I would never see this play. And I was actually dreading seeing this production, and so I'm glad it paid off.
And it reminded me, again, how important it is to see these plays performed. Much like how we talk about, you know, with what we're reading, and I've been reading the poetry of Wallace Stevens, how important it is to read these aloud.
Yes.
Poetry is meant to be read aloud. Plays are meant to be performed. It is fun reading them.
Right.
However, it is fantastic to see them performed.
Enlivened.
We saw two excellent performances. It's a two-hander, Danny and the Deep Blue Sea, playing for one more week, Crown City Theater.
Right.
Juliet Landau, of course, who everyone loves.
And from Buffy?
Right, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, yeah, right? Six seasons or something like that?
Yeah, that's right.
And also that the role she played, Drusilla, recurred on Angel as well. She's very popular for Justice League.
Of course.
And Ed Wood.
Yes, she was in Ed Wood.
The cult film, The Toolbox Murders. So many great things, and just a fantastic actress. And it really came together because this was a part she wanted to play.
Yeah, yeah.
And her co-star in the film, also excellent, Matthew J. Williamson.
I thought it was really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was really surprised. And so often...
He was pitch perfect in the piece.
So often the sensitivity goes away for the... when you get into being a gruff guy who gets into fights all the time and all that anger. I've seen so many actors just tap into the anger and forget everything else that it was nice to see the full rounded character.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Speaking of live events of the week.
What?
There are a couple of live events coming up in which we are participating, Dean.
Well, it's certainly true.
One is this Friday.
My gosh, coming right up.
A dinner and a movie screening at Marika Live, the organic watering hole in Studio City. Very cool place.
Yep.
This Friday, 30th of March, 7:30 p.m.
Yes.
Dinner and a movie. Admission is free, though people are requested to purchase food and drink. Why would you not want to? The organic menu, fantastic.
Delicious.
And these, cocktails.
Hello, cocktails.
Go down smooth.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I will be there.
We'll be there.
Participating, introducing the film, participating in a post-screening discussion.
A lovely Q&A, as always.
So you can always visit the Truth Is Out There website, truth-is-out-there.com.
Yes.
To find out about events like this, we'll also post the link there on our Chopac Hollywood website.
Yes.
And then in a couple weeks, on Sunday, April 15th, Tax Day, we will be in the state capitol. We will be occupying Sacramento.
Occupy!
The Guild Theater for a movies on a big screen screening.
Right.
It's a screening series in Sacramento, movies on a big screen at the Guild Theater. And we'll be there showing Truth Is Out There.
That will be exciting on tax day, because then I don't have to mail my taxes. I can just walk them in.
Well, it is a Sunday. You can't mail them anyway.
Damn it.
Yeah, I think they give us till the 16th because it's on a Sunday.
Okay, so then I'll wait a day. I'll file an extension.
That extension.
Yes.
I will wait a day to file that extension.
Wow, that'll be fun. I'm looking forward to Sacramento, and it's been a while since I've been there.
I think this is a good segue into the Chilpack Hollywood explanation of the week.
Right.
The Chilpack Hollywood explanation of the week.
Thank you for that.
I paused.
We are embarking upon making two sequels to The Truth Is Out There. What is it? Not simultaneously. What do you say?
Concurrently.
Concurrently, yeah. Truth Is Out There, Ancient Mysteries, and The Truth Is Out There, Business as Usual.
Yes.
And I wanted to take the time...
To explain
what we mean by business as usual.
As we know, we saw, for those of you who saw our documentary, Mark Bennett, of course, explained that there is no conspiracies, but there's just business as usual. Business operates as a pyramid scheme, with the top person knowing and disseminating that information to the ranks below, so that if you are in the lower ranks, you don't know anything.
That was explained by someone else.
Yes, that was explained by
Bruno Brewiler.
Yeah.
Because that was the interesting thing about it, was we were taken by Mark Bennett's phrase, there isn't so much conspiracy as there's business as usual. What was also very interesting was how many people echoed that without knowing that this is something that really weaves
through conspiracy.
Bruno had the exact opposite. He says that everything is a conspiracy.
Right.
All of business is a conspiracy. Whereas Mark has the point of view, no business is a conspiracy. It's just business.
That's how business is done.
And that's the idea, is that how business is done might be horrifying. It might be just amoral.
Right.
once you understand the bottom line of how that industry works, though, and that bottom line is not hidden. It's not secretive
right.
in any way. It's just how you get motivated by that bottom line seems to be so inhuman sometimes
right.
that it takes on the tone of conspiracy, but it isn't. It's just amoral business as usual. And we have many examples in the film of technologies or innovations that could help mankind throughout the ages and right now. And these things are available to us or would be available to us if we knew about them.
Right.
And the reason we don't know about them is business as usual.
It cures, yes.
Because they either threaten the bottom line of that industry, the money-making potential, or they don't fit into the marketplace through any kind of marketing or distribution scheme that is the way business is done.
Absolutely. You know what we should talk to is Elon Musk, a guy up in Fremont, California, who's doing the electric car, the Tesla. And he's done the sports car, and now he's trying to come out next year with the family sedan. And he's facing how business is done in Detroit by starting an all-electric car company here in California, in Silicon Valley. And there is a case of millions of dollars and the business ethic of Silicon Valley going up against how business is done in Detroit and how the combustion engine, which only provides, you know, 20% of the fuel goes to moving the car forward and the other 80% is all heat.
And this is a topic that is starting to become really interesting to people and is starting to get covered in especially newspaper articles, mm-hmm. and magazine articles. So this is, we're dedicating a whole film to this. Truth is out there, business as usual, about many of the innovations and inventions and solutions that either exist in nature right now or that people have come up with as simple solutions to potentially complex problems that could help all of us if only we could know about them.
Right.
And so that's what where we're aiming our focus. And I thought, because of a couple of questions we've had asked to us, either at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, where
Easy.
People can write us, or on Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood, where mm-hmm. people can also post comments. We've had a couple of questions about the Chill Pack.
Yes.
And I thought it would be important once and for all to pull no punches to discuss the sad fate of the Chill Pack in relation to business as usual. The first question came from Stephen Lee, who simply asked the question, how can he get a Chill Pack?
Right.
We still call the show Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and
right.
we call it that largely because of this issue, because there are solutions all around us in the world that maybe aren't being used as widely as they could be simply because no one gets to know about them, and no one gets to know about them because it's business as usual. And so to show solidarity with all those undiscovered solutions, we will continue to call the show Chill Pack Hollywood right. Hour in honor of the late, great Chill Pack. So, Stephen, no, there is no way to get Chill Pack. There is
right.
no way.
There's no way.
There is no way
yes.
to get it. Yeah. For those who have joined us recently on show, Chill Pack is an invention from Dean Haglund.
Thank you very much.
A very simple, inexpensive, environmentally friendly solution to the problem of heat generated by your laptop computer. Heat that affects performance on your computer, affects its
lifespan.
It warps the core.
Yes.
It is bad for the environment. And you came up with a solution. Like I said, easy to use.
Easy to use. Goes in the freezer, goes directly under the laptop, cools it out.
Draws heat away from the CPU.
Absolutely. It had a condensation-proof sleeve, so no moisture developed. Insulated on the bottom, so you can put it in your lap.
And you developed this.
Yes.
Thinking, in no small part because of all the people who told you right. how useful and brilliant this was, thinking that once you got the word out enough, this was going to be not only a big seller, but something that would be
embraced
on every computer website, in every computer store.
Yes.
And the folly, as it turns out,
my licking of the wounds
of that idea was it ignored how business is done, the operating principle of the bottom line,
right,
that laptop manufacturers in particular would never be able to embrace or endorse it because, one, they would be admitting that heat was a problem.
Right. And therefore, there's many lawsuits out there of people who've burnt parts of their body off their laptops. That admission of liability would cost them...
foreseeable liability, too.
Right. And that would be...
That would be costly.
That would be costly in terms of payouts and lawsuits.
And then also the fact that they're admitting that they know they're generating something with built-in obsolescence.
Right.
When that obsolescence could be prevented through a simple chill pack.
Right. And that you would extend the life of a laptop and you wouldn't be buying one every 3 years or however.
So, of course, the laptop manufacturers are not going to embrace it or endorse it.
Right.
And, of course, as excited as computer stores and websites were about this product, they ultimately rely on their relationships with the laptop manufacturers.
Right. That these are the ones that pay by the advertising for these websites, that give them freebies and that sort of thing. So are they going to then tout a small laptop cooling solution? Or are they going to praise the next iPad coming down the pike because they get a free one?
So this made many people angry when they learned about it. It made me angry. I was more angry than you. I mean, at the point when you decided to shut down ChillPack,
yes,
it was really, from my perspective, you had just kind of, you'd pushed that boulder.
It was a hell of a
up
boulder.
Up the hill,
yep.
Long enough.
Single-handedly.
You were going to have to continue to work so hard at it to get to the point where finally the research and the development that you had put in, the production money you had put in, allowed you to break even off of it. Only it really wasn't a break-even proposition because you'd put so much time and effort into
right.
it.
And it was going to continue on a downward scale because you continually had to remarket and... it wasn't a new product anymore. So then all of a sudden it's this old product that,
right.
you know, it had lost its youthful
so do you
figure on the marketplace.
Continue to push it just to be able to do that? You know, at some point you just got exhausted.
Yes. And to maintain that debt load and all that sort of thing, because you're going to continually incur debt pushing that product. And then how many do you have to sell before you ever see a profit?
So it's... many of us got angry, and ultimately, it's not something to get angry about because it's business as usual.
Right. And so here's a case of a product, an innovation, that is that a conspiracy? Would that be the conspiracy, or is that just how global marketplaces work?
Right.
And so...
and Linda Van Manen...
yes.
has been pushing ChillPack. I don't know if she realizes that there are no ChillPacks to help people, but there has been such a huge problem
yes.
with the unprecedented sales of the iPad 3.
Right.
The iPad 3, the heat generated by this is such an enormous problem. And guess what, people? It's only going to become a greater and greater problem.
Right, because you're going to want faster and faster products that are going to be more and more heat coming
Am I wrong in thinking that the ChillPack was, designed to be the perfect size for the iPad?
It is actually the exact same size as an iPad. It can strap on the back of it. For those of you who have an iPad 3 and you were smart enough to buy a ChillPack... 5 years ago, you are sitting in the driver's seat right now, my friends. Everyone else, I apologize.
And it's really, you know, it's this whole idea of business as usual is to a degree what occupies much of our conversation here on ChillPack Hollywood Hour as it relates to the entertainment industry so often.
Absolutely. Same idea that great scripts, brilliant writing, great movies that are actually somehow put together, never see a theater or the light of day because of marketing or whatever, that you're flooded out by the noise of Hunger Games or
why don't we use that as a beautiful segue into your ChillPack Hollywood lawsuit of the week?
Well, that's a beautiful segue.
The ChillPack Hollywood lawsuit of the week.
What's your lawsuit of the week?
David Boies and Ted Olson, two great constitutional attorneys
yes
who were the lead attorneys in the successful legal challenge to the constitutionality of California's Proposition 8,
right,
which took away
human rights
from homosexuals the right to marry, mm-hmm. same-sex couples from marrying. They have raised now the threat. I guess this should be threatened lawsuit of the week.
Threatened lawsuit of the week.
Of taking the MPAA. This is the ratings organization, the lobbyist organization for the motion picture industry.
Yeah.
Taking the MPAA to court.
Whoa.
Over the R rating that the Classification and Ratings Administration has given to the documentary Bully.
This is Bully, yeah.
Now, I love this team up of David Boyce and Ted Olson, because these are two men. This is one of my things that I love. You know, we live in an era where it seems as if political opponents can't even be friendly anymore, right. Can't carry on civil discourse. And these are two people who have been on the opposite side of very contentious constitutional debates before.
Yes.
Ted Olson was Solicitor General for President George W. Bush.
Oh.
David Boies, of course, was Al Gore's constitutional lawyer in the constitutional battle over the recount in Florida.
Oh, my gosh.
They come together for Proposition 8.
Right.
For a human rights issue.
Right. This is a...
And here they are working together again on crafting the legal threat, the threat of legal action
for
the MPAA.
For those who don't know, Bully is a documentary about bullying that is...
In schools.
Bullying in schools that now the MPAA say is too graphic or too violent to show kids.
I think it's language.
Oh, it's language.
What they said was language.
Oh, so as a documentary, the kids are swearing and stuff. And
you have a certain number of swear words you're allowed.
Right.
And this film is set to be released on March 30th.
Right. That's next Friday.
And
this Friday.
Apparently the language of these kids is what garnered this film an R rating, which has become a lightning rod for controversy after the Weinstein Company disputed that rating, going so far as having Harvey Weinstein himself appeal to the MPAA.
Wow.
Which did not work. Generally, that kind of appeal will work.
Sort of do that sort of thing.
And he insisted that children under 17, after all, about whom this film is.
Right. Who are saying those words.
Should be allowed to watch the film about them.
Right. In order, because this is something that would be educational of the effects of bullying and that sort of thing.
Speaking this last week at the Paley Center for Media in New York, at a screening of the film co-hosted by Meryl Streep and tennis legend Billie Jean King,
wow.
David Boies said, quote, how ridiculous and unfair and damaging it is to have a film of this power and importance that is being censored by a rating system that has got simply no rational basis. You can kill kids in films, you can maim them, you can torture them, and still get a PG-13 rating.
Right.
But there are only so many bad words, apparently, that these kids are allowed to say. And raising the possibility of taking the MPAA to court, he added, I hope for heaven's sake that they find some rational basis before we have to sue them to revise the entire rating system.
Wow.
Although, as we've said, it's high time.
It is high time, you know.
Because the definition of, the defense the MPAA has constantly in cases like this about why they uphold their ratings is they constantly say it's not about this one film. If we made an exception, no matter how appropriate for this one film, well, then everyone will expect it.
And you won't. I mean, that's ridiculous. I hate that argument.
No law, no rule is ever meant to be absolute. There can be no justice as long as there is.
Right. But the idea being that if that floodgate is opened, then everyone will march through here demanding an exception.
So the bottom line really is, why are they inflexible? Because this is how they do business.
Yeah.
They're not going to change how they do business because they don't know how they would do business then.
Right. They have no model on how to be flexible.
Right.
So what a drag that is.
Did you see any movies this week?
I did not see any movies this week.
I thought you would see The Hunger Games.
You would think that, right? And I did not.
I didn't bother because I thought you would.
Well, you know, I already saw it in a Japanese movie called Battle Royale. Thank you very much. I didn't know you could do this, that I could just watch some really great 1980s Japanese movies, then write books about it and call it something completely different, and then make a movie on those books. Had I known that, watch for my upcoming novel series about the girl with the chainsaw of her hand, the schoolgirl who has a chainsaw, and she kills all her enemies. How about that? I'm going to write that book series.
Have you been reading any books? What are you reading, Dean Haglund?
I'm just finishing my Titian book, and then going on to the history of France through art, and then I'm doing all my Flash learning books.
Right, Flash animation learning Flash books. Animation. We just have to check in on this, hold our feet to the fire every week.
Yes.
I'm still just trudging the path of happy destiny on John Adams, David McCullough's John Adams,
yes.
About a third of the way through that epic tome, and continuing my enjoyment of the Wallace Stevens poetry.
I got The Snowman, the Swedish crime novel, next on my list. This is the second most famous Swedish author after Girl with the Green Dragon Tattoo author, and so I'm looking forward to reading that. Going to crack it this week.
I saw three films
this week.
One that we found out about because of our screening at the Northwest Film Forum in Seattle.
In Seattle.
Northwest Film Forum is thanked in the end credits of this film. I'm talking about The Catechism Cataclysm.
Yes.
A comedy. It's a comedy.
It's comedy.
From Todd Rohal, 2011 release. And an independent film that focuses on maybe the least effective, least suitable priest that there's ever been, who is ordered by his superiors to go on a little vacation.
Uh-huh.
And he does so, and his vacation turns out something akin to deliverance.
Ah.
A comedic deliverance, or as I like to call it, Deliverance.
Zingers.
It is an odd film, but the lead performance by the cat who plays the priest is so delightful. There are times it almost reminds me, look, it's not as good as either of these films, but at its best, it's Napoleon Dynamite meets Deliverance.
Wow. Wow. Somebody pitched that to me.
And it's 75 minutes long. It's brisk and it's a fun little view.
Oh, that's
there are
fun.
Some things that even when it's not working made me laugh.
So,
and again, you know, this is the beauty of finding your own distribution methodology. You know, they get places like the Northwest Film Forum to show it. And why are theatrical screenings still important? Not necessarily to get butts in the seats there, but to have the poster up, to have the show times listed,
and chatted.
To be able to send out email blasts like we do,
yep,
about the film, to let people know who may never have heard about the film before that such a thing exists.
Right.
It's inexpensive marketing.
That's right.
To set up screenings this way, and you get eyeballs on your poster who find out about it.
Speaking of which, is our poster up at that Marquee Live restaurant?
The Marika Live restaurant? Is our poster up there?
Yeah.
No, I guess we could do that.
Why don't we do that?
Okay. Why don't you head on over there?
Okay.
And do that.
I'll leave now.
I saw a serial killer movie.
What?
You know, always my favorite.
You're not your favorite.
From 1971, directed by Richard Fleischer.
Oh, my gosh.
10 Rillington Place.
Oh.
A true story.
Ooh.
Set in the 1940s.
Ooh.
But a serial killer played by Richard Attenborough.
Come on.
And in a BAFTA-nominated supporting actor performance that is one of the great performances I have ever seen by an actor, a very young John Hurt.
Come on.
Who's so extraordinary.
So I get
this.
Sir Richard Attenborough and John Hurt in a serial killer movie I've never heard of.
And it is, and it's a true story.
Wow.
And again, it's the sort of movie that makes you go, You know, Silence of the Lambs, really? And if not Silence of the Lambs, then certainly the sequels to it.
Yeah.
And things like Dexter and things like this. It's like, wow, boy, we have no interest in doing anything authentic.
Wow. Okay, now I have to see this. How?
10 Burlington Place. It's not, for some reason, it's not available on DVD, and yet Tucker Smallwood gave me a DVD.
What?
Of it.
Perhaps you're giving me that very DVD.
Perhaps. I also saw the film version from 1985, the Oscar-winning film version of The Trip to Bountiful.
Oh, yes.
I let enough time lapse, I felt, between seeing the production at South Coast Rep and seeing the much-loved film version.
Yes.
And it was fascinating to see this on the same weekend that we saw Danny and the Deep Blue Sea, which was directed by John McNaughton, Danny and the Deep Blue Sea.
Right.
A very famous film director who made movies like
Mad Dog and Glory
and Wild Things, both of which incorporate this sleight of hand element that made him a good fit for Danny and the Deep Blue Sea on stage.
Right.
There were moments that you felt would have been better served by having a theater director.
I agree. Yes.
And so it was interesting for me, therefore, to see The Trip to Bountiful the same weekend, where Peter Masterson made his directorial debut, and I think his experience had been largely theater.
Right.
And this was a case where the film version really needed a film director.
Ah, yes. I think it did.
This film has such a wonderful reputation, largely because it gave the fantastic Geraldine Page her Oscar-winning film role. She'd been nominated 6 times prior without winning. She would be dead within a couple of years. Finally won Best Actress. When the Oscar was presented to her by F. Murray Abraham, he said, and the winner is the greatest actress in the English language, Geraldine Page. So that's one of the reasons. And in fact, the story is told that when she, on the last day of shooting Trip to Bountiful, she turned to the producer after they wrapped her and said, okay, go get me the Oscar.
Yeah.
Because she knew that she'd really brought it.
Wow.
And she's extraordinary. It is an acting class.
Yeah.
You know, a master class in acting, watching. In film acting, it's a master class in acting, watching it. So that's wonderful. The play itself, you know, had such an interesting track record because it actually started as a film. It was written as a teleplay and a play simultaneously.
Oh, I did not
know
that.
They shot the TV movie starring Lillian Gish and Eva Marie Saint.
Yeah.
1953, I think it was, while they were rehearsing for the Broadway production.
Uh-huh.
So it in the early days of television.
Yes.
And then it appeared for 39 performances on Broadway. It was not a hit.
Wow.
Was not well received. And it took time before its reputation grew. And I think he continued to tinker with the script, quite frankly.
Right.
The script to the production that we saw, the full play, is better than his teleplay, his screenplay, for the film version in 1985.
Wow.
And the editing was so awkward at times.
Really?
The direction so awkward in terms of even screen direction being wrong. Lines being jumped.
Crossing the axis.
Crossing the axis back and forth.
No way.
Rapid edits as if to try to make it more filmic. That deflated the emotional impact because it cut out transition.
Really?
It was really interesting.
Wow. So this is I often like seeing bad productions and bad movies because it is actually like film school and acting class, that if you see mistakes, you then can go, aha, the correction here, and then this is a way to learn. So I'm now fascinated to see this 85 Trip to Bountiful.
They're making a film version of the Tony-winning August Osage County.
Yes.
Starring Meryl Streep and Julia Roberts. It's a fantastic play, and it was one of the greatest plays of all time with the original cast.
Right.
It was a very good play with the replacement cast.
Right.
Again, casting is so important.
So important.
Especially when it's an ensemble piece.
Uh-huh.
This could make a great film. And there was, of course, as we've talked about before, the perfect director to make August Osage County. His name was Robert Altman. He's not with us anymore.
Right.
So what will happen with this film version? It's a long play. One of the things you figure is going to happen. Two things happen in when plays get adapted to the screen.
One.
Often they try to expand them outward.
Open it up. As
open
they
it up. And they try to compress them in terms of running time.
Yes.
What's interesting is that second is probably the opposite of what you should do. No matter how long a play is, on film, you might want to increase the length.
Right, because you want to get into the details of set, sun, and scenery, and bring it in closer on the
invite the intimacy invite that the you intimacy. Can only have in film,
right?
But that gets denied through rapid cutting and rapid transition.
And just trying to get through all the text. I mean, that's exactly. often the case is let's keep the lines as much as possible.
I think in mentioning that, of course, Robert Altman is no longer with us, which should be news to no one. We should address celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Really, we're going to do that now?
We have two. Why not close with people who were anything other than business as usual? Really,
excellent. Yeah.
Two giants in terms of talent.
Okay.
That died this past week.
Who's that?
The first, one of cinema's great writers, three-time Oscar nominee Tonino Guerra.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He wrote over 100 screenplays. He was a poet and a screenwriter from Northern Italy.
Wow.
His screenplays, just to mention a few, L'Avventura,
oh, yes.
La Notte, La Clisse, Blow Up, Zabriskie Point, all for Antonioni.
Yes.
How about Amacord?
Yes.
And The Ship Sails On, Ginger and Fred for Fellini, Nostalgia for Tarkovsky.
Holy smokes.
You see a little bit of a pattern?
Yeah, I do.
The greatest directors in history wanted this guy
to write
writing their films. Vittorio De Sico's Marriage Italian Style. I mean, I could go on and on and on.
Yeah,
he was nominated, like I said, for 3 Oscars, Amacord, Blow Up, Casanova 70, won Best Screenplay at Cannes in 1984
really?
For Voyage to Cythera, and has been honored at the Venice Film Festival. Italy's David Di Donatello Awards for Career Lifetime Achievement in 2010.
I would say so.
And in 2011, the Writers Guild of America gave him his Jean Renoir Award for Screenwriting Achievement by an international writer.
I'm glad you said it. I thought you were going to end with, and the screenwriter took away his union card. What? No, that would be horrible.
In the honoring of him with that Lifetime Achievement Award, this was the statement that the Writers Guild issued. By any standard, one of the great writers of our times, his medium is the screenplay. Guerra's work is the brave and moral thread that runs through the fabric of modernist cinema. He is a breathtaking poet, a generous collaborator, and is possessed of the largest heart. Heart, generosity, and poetry, clearly not business as usual.
Clearly not.
And yet that's why he's remembered and that's why he's celebrated, because after all, what does art require? It requires something to push off against.
Absolutely.
So it's easy to rant against business as usual, harder sometimes to say how does this serve, but it allows for someone like this giant of screenwriting to be able to really stand out. The other man that I wanted to mention who died this past week was director Ulu Grosbard, a 2-time Tony Award nominee, whose credits include films collaborating with Dustin Hoffman, several collaborations with Robert Duvall. He was 83. He was nominated for his first Tony in 1965 for directing The Subject Was Roses.
Oh, yeah, classic.
Frank D. Gilroy's Pulitzer Prize-winning drama about a soldier played in the production by Martin Sheen.
Wow.
And this is something that I've been told about some of my old-timer friends in New York.
Find some.
Still to this day talk about that performance and that production.
Really?
As being one of the great performances that they've ever seen.
How about that?
His second nomination came in 1977 for the original Broadway production of David Mamet's American Buffalo.
Wow.
And it starred Robert Duvall. He directed such films as Who is Harry Kellerman and Why is He Saying Those Terrible Things About Me right. in 1971.
That's a great
and
one.
Straight Time in 1978, both starring Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
Helmed the 1968 screen adaptation of The Subject Was Roses, that in which Martin Sheen
reprised his role.
And other credits include the Robert De Niro Meryl Streep vehicle, Falling in Love.
Oh, yeah.
And Georgia in 1995. So he was active even last decade with Jennifer Jason Leigh and Mare Winningham and The Deep End of the Ocean in 1999 with Michelle Pfeiffer and Treat Williams.
Oh, wow.
So here was a man who excelled both stage and screen as a director.
Fantastic. Wow. Then we end our show, as always, saying
what? I would like to know how we end each show. We've already talked about a lot of things.
We didn't find us on Facebook. We didn't mention
that. We mentioned Facebook. We mentioned ChillPackHollywood at yahoo.com.
We mentioned our Twitter accounts.
You can follow us on Twitter.
Yes, I'm at DHaglin.
I'm at Phil Lairness. And you can find many, many, many episodes of your ChillPack Hollywood Hour at ChillPackHollywood.com, ChillPackHollywood.com. You can download us. You can stream us.
Yes.
You can subscribe through our website via iTunes and really simple syndication.
So easy.
And there may be in the works the possibility of us moving full time to a network.
Whoa.
So stay tuned.
Stay tuned for that chatter. That'll be awesome. Till then, I'm Dean Haglin.
I'm Phil Lairness. Bye.
Belated spoiler alert.